This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara. This Thursday, historic defence deal between Australia, the US and UK and a switch to nuclear submarines. And stuck at home without answers. Why are residents of Western Sydney stranded in isolation for weeks? You'll hear their stories.
All the text messages say 14 days, but something's not working, whether it's a system or communication. It's just making it very difficult for us as a family, but I'm sure that some of the staff are getting quite distressing phone calls from people in our situation.
Australia has changed tack on a major defence strategy, ditching a problem-plagued submarine contract to instead opt for a nuclear-powered alternative. The United States and the UK are partners in the project, providing the technology required for Australia to operate its own nuclear subs in the Indo-Pacific region. The decision is being welcomed by the defence industry as a crucial improvement in our capabilities, but concerns remain about the use of nuclear power in Australia. Isabel Rowe reports.
Well, good morning from Australia.
In an early morning joint announcement beamed from three countries, AUKUS was born.
I'm very pleased to join two great friends of freedom and of Australia, Prime Minister Johnson and President Biden.
Prime Minister Scott Morrison unveiled the Trilateral Defence Partnership, a collaboration between Australia, the United Kingdom and the United States. Its first project, building Australia a fleet of nuclear-powered submarines to defend itself in an age of uncertainty.
Our world is becoming more complex, especially here in our region, the Indo-Pacific. This affects us all. The future of the Indo-Pacific will impact all our futures. Let me be clear. Australia is not seeking to acquire nuclear weapons or establish a civil nuclear capability. And we will continue to meet all our nuclear non-proliferation obligations.
The submarine fleet will be built in Adelaide, but much of the expertise, technology and likely the nuclear reactors will be delivered by the United States, an indication of how important Australia's capability is to the US, even if US President Joe Biden appeared to briefly forget the Prime Minister's name.
Thank you, Boris. And I want to thank that fellow down under. Thank you very much, pal.
Unlike the current diesel battery-powered boats, nuclear submarines can last for 30 years without coming up for air. The US already has some, and so does China. Former Chief of Defence, retired Admiral Chris Barry, says going nuclear was the obvious decision.
What we will acquire is better transit speeds and a greater operational endurance. Some in China might well say this is a response to our concerns over China, but the conversation about acquiring nuclear-powered submarines has been going on since the 1960s. So it is a question of a political judgment inside Australia. Nuclear-powered submarines have been visiting our bases in Western Australia for the last 35 years or so. So it won't be new for that.
Concerns about nuclear power have hampered plans for this sort of technology before. Green Senator Adam Bandt told News Breakfast his party would fight their introduction.
Australia can chart a course that attempts to de-escalate tensions in our region, and instead, what the Prime Minister is doing is putting floating Chernobyls in the heart of our major cities, not explaining what the risk is going to be.
But the Submarine Institute of Australia's David Nicholls wants to reassure the public that nuclear technology and safety has come a long way.
Nuclear engineering technology has gone forward in leaps and bounds over the last few years. We now have submarines in UK and US that do not need refueling for the life of the hull, which is in excess of 30 years. So the reactor remains consistently capable for that period of time.
And I think those that have concerns about safety should look closely at what those advances have been over the last few years. And there have been very, very few instances that I'm aware of in UK and US nuclear submarine history involving dangerous situations.
The nuclear subs plan means Australia will scrap its deal with the French company Naval Group, which was building $90 billion worth of conventional submarines. Since being released in 2017, the coalition's naval shipbuilding plan has been plagued with contractual disputes, design problems and cost blowouts. In a statement, Naval Group says it's a major disappointment that the Australian government has decided not to proceed with the next phase of the program. It's come as a shock to the company's Adelaide-based workforce, many of whom heard on their way to work this morning.
Heading to the office, let's see what happens. I'm not really sure how to react at the moment. We were not expecting this, yes.
Former submariner and independent Senator Rex Patrick is calling for a parliamentary inquiry into the details before the deal is finalised.
That's Isabel Rowe reporting there. Well, building sophisticated defence capability can come with an enormous price tag. And for Australia, it seems many defence projects inevitably involve a cost blowout. So what's the impact of this project on the budget bottom line? Rachel Mealy takes a look.
Submarines don't come cheap, and when you're comparing a French model to an American one, you want to get some bang for your buck.
Both of these options are going to be very expensive, so we want to get the best capability we possibly can if we're going to make that really challenging investment.
Professor Rory Medcalf is the head of the National Security College at the Australian National University. He says the decision to change the course of Australia's submarine program has been driven by an emerging threat from China.
My sense is this is driven primarily by having the best capability for Australia, the best submarine deterrent capability in a worsening strategic environment where China's power and assertiveness are growing. Cost is an issue, but cost, I think, is increasingly a secondary issue.
Australia currently spends about 2% of its GDP every year on defence. Professor Medcalf says Australia's defence spending has been low in relative terms compared to our neighbours, and it might be time to spend a bit more to get a bit more sophistication.
We've gotten by with 2% or less for many years in a strategic environment that's getting worse, where other countries are spending more, where Australia's relative weight in the region is declining.
But he also believes Australia's new involvement in the trilateral alliance known as AUKUS will bring some cost advantages.
If Australia was going to be operating without the alliance with the United States or others, then those numbers could really blow out to 4% or more. I think somewhere between 2-3% is plausible for the next generation or so.
Peter Jennings is the executive director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. He sees a similar growth in defence spending.
I think it's inevitable we're going to have to look at increasing our defence spending from around 2% of gross national product to perhaps 3 or 4% of gross national product, because that's the kind of scale that we will need to contemplate in order to be able to deliver this nuclear submarine program.
I mean, let's be clear, the $90 billion French procurement was chosen because it was the best value for money. Like, we ruled out other options when we chose to spend $90 billion on the French sub. So inevitably this means more money will be spent and it'll be longer before we see new subs coming on board.
That's Dr. Richard Dennis, chief economist at the progressive think tank, the Australia Institute. He warns any potential doubling of defence spending will be a significant drain on the national budget, already set to stay in the red for years to come as a result of the pandemic and the souring of the trade relationship with China. Extra spending would be a further drain on the economy before any benefit is felt.
The reality is the Australian government spends around $500 billion a year. Spending on defence accounts for an enormous proportion of that. So, yes, spending more on more submarines will hurt the bottom line, but it's not going to create any jobs in the short term. This is going to take years to even finish the paperwork on. It'll be a long time before any welder is employed in Adelaide.
That's Richard Dennis, Chief Economist at the Australia Institute, and that report from Rachel Mealy. Well, the Prime Minister and senior Australian officials are scrambling to reassure other countries in the region about the implications of the submarine decision. France has responded furiously, saying the United States is behaving incoherently and undermining its relationship with Australia. Our Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts joins us now. Stephen, it's been a long night for you and other reporters. Why is the government so keen to calm regional partners about this announcement?
Well, largely because there's so much unease and hesitancy in the region, historically at least, about Australia taking on big new defence commitments. In particular, in countries like Indonesia, they've always looked somewhat suspiciously at Australia, particularly when large amounts of money are invested in big new capabilities such as this with the submarines. You might remember a decade ago, Indonesia also responded furiously when Australia announced it would rotate US Marines through Darwin. So historically, there's quite a lot of baggage there. Now, that's shifted in the last few years. Southeast Asian countries, including Indonesia, are now more comfortable with Australia boosting its defence spend, in part because they want to also see China effectively balanced in the region. But this is still going to take very careful handling. And that's probably why the Prime Minister has been on the phone already, speaking to leaders in the region, New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, to Yoshihide Suga, the Japanese Prime Minister Narendra Modi from India, trying to reassure them that this isn't targeted at them. He'll also speak to Singapore's Prime Minister, as well as the Prime Ministers of PNG and Fiji later today. We haven't, though, yet heard much from any regional leaders, aside from Jacinda Ardern, New Zealand's Prime Minister. She was certainly not hostile to the arrangement, but she did emphasise that, and this is according to long-standing New Zealand policy, no nuclear-powered vessels or submarines would be allowed in New Zealand's waters. And that will include these new submarines when they do eventually become a reality.
Stephen, what's been the domestic political reaction so far?
We've heard a little bit, of course, in earlier packages, including a furious response from the Greens, who have warned that that these new submarines will present an enormous security risk. They've been referred to as floating Chernobyls, and that they could also escalate tensions in the region. But what we're all really waiting on now is the response from the opposition leader, Anthony Albanese, who is expected to speak pretty soon. The government has been very keen to get a bipartisan response on this. They want Labor on side. They don't want this to become a political hot potato, and it seems confident that it can get Labor on board. And for that end, Anthony Albanese and other senior Labor frontbenchers were briefed by government officials late yesterday. So it will be important to hear what Anthony Albanese has to say on this front, and we shouldn't have to wait too long for that.
Stephen, thank you. That's our Foreign Affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgetts. On ABC Radio across Australia, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. Australia's unemployment rate has fallen to 4.5% in August, the lowest level in more than a decade. That's despite more than 100,000 Australians losing work and millions in lost working hours across the country. To help make sense of the figures, I'm joined now by our business reporter, David Taylor. David, good afternoon. The data suggests more Australians are in work, but are they really?
Good afternoon, Sal. No, in fact, it's less. Look, the data covers the first 2 weeks of August, which included ongoing lockdowns in New South Wales, new lockdowns in Victoria, Queensland and the ACT. Now, that led to economic damage and job losses. Full-time employment decreased by 68,000 and part-time employment decreased by 78,200. There were big falls in New South Wales in both employment, down over 173,000, and hours worked down around about 6.5%. Sal, nationally, monthly hours worked decreased by a whopping 66 million hours.
So, David, why has the unemployment rate fallen?
Well, this is the thing, and it's a bit tricky to get your head around, but basically the participation rate decreased to 65.2%. The national participation rate fell by 0.8 percentage points following a 0.2 percentage point fall in July. Now, I've thrown a lot of figures at you there, which probably aren't a huge amount of sense-making figures, but when you look at the basic fundamental problem that's going on at the moment, job seekers, Sal, are opting out of the labour force. And in fact, they're not looking for work. So you've got plenty of people, hundreds of thousands of people that have lost jobs. But you've also got this side effect where people that might have otherwise been looking for work have seen that and forced into lockdown and perhaps can't look for a job for whatever reason have said, look, it's just not the time for me to find work. And they've opted out of the labour force altogether, opted out of the statistics, and that's meant they're not included in it. So there's a ratio that you put numbers into in order to get the unemployment rate, and that ratio has been turned on its head, essentially. I should also say there was a large drop in the New South Wales participation rate, down 2.5 percentage points, and that follows a 1 percentage point fall in the previous month. So New South Wales and Victoria clearly leading the falls here.
And David, what about those who still have their jobs? What do we know about job security?
Well, I think it's fair to say there's a lot of job insecurity, because if you look at the hours that were lost, especially in August, it's painting a picture that those, so we've talked about those not looking for work at all, but those in work, it seems that they've been stood down on 0 hours, or they're working reduced hours, because let's face it, there aren't that many. The economic activity that we're experiencing is reduced and there's not the need for the staff. Compared with August 2019, there was an extra 1.2 million people employed who worked reduced hours for economic or other reasons in August 2021. Now, that includes 532,000 people who worked, say, no hours for those reasons. So the large fall in hours worked saw the underemployment rates, those wanting more hours and more work, drop for, I should say, increase for the third consecutive month. So up a full percentage point, Sal, to 9.3% in August.
David, thank you. That's our business reporter, David Taylor. Well, a new report has found that working from home is probably here to stay even after the pandemic. A major review by the Productivity Commission says the number of Australians working from home has jumped from 8% to around 40% in the past 2 years. That's a big increase. Commission Chair Michael Brennan is speaking here with our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan.
I think it's likely that working from home will continue at higher levels than we saw before the pandemic. Maybe not so much at the levels we've seen at the height of lockdown, but somewhere in between.
Should any employer be standing in the way of people who want to work from home now that it's almost the norm?
It's important to weigh up the flexibility that is good for employees in terms of the commute that is avoided or the flexibility they have when working from home with the sorts of benefits that in-person interaction give you for collaboration, often for creativity. So I think employers should take a hard-headed assessment and see what the right balance is.
It seems inevitable that more people will choose to work from home, but will that option or expectation now be a factor when it comes to someone choosing their next job?
It's reasonable to expect that because the commute for many people is quite significant, it's a meaningful cost in terms of the time spent commuting to work, that it's large enough that it might make a difference to the job that someone might choose. And anecdotally, you do hear of people starting to look around to try and find a job and a workplace that's right for them.
But could working from home become such an important factor that some employees would take a pay cut to do it?
There is some survey evidence that suggests people value it enough to take a pay cut, mainly from the United States. I'm a little skeptical about whether that would happen in reality, but I do think it's something that many workers value, and I think it's something that they will be seeking to negotiate with their employer.
Is there a risk of a stigma for people who insist on working from home who are accused of shirking it from home?
I think that has been a feature in the past, that there's been a tendency to think that those who work from home perhaps were less industrious. I don't think that's quite so true going forward. I think the more people embrace working from home, some of that stigma has broken down.
Then again, we are social creatures, and I'm working from home, but I miss my colleagues and kicking around ideas, and that doesn't always work over technology, does it?
No, I agree. I think those are reasons why the hybrid model is tending to emerge as the model that many workplaces are gravitating towards, because it combines the best of a bit of physical interaction with some of the flexibility from working from home some of the time.
As you say, this is all evolving, but do you see any industrial relations risks or risks of legal action if an employer tries to force a worker back into the office against his or her will?
I think it's the sort of thing that employers and individuals are going to have to work through in a negotiated and mutually agreeable way.
Do you see the willingness to work at home or pressure to work at home becoming part of industrial relations reform?
I think largely this is occurring outside the formal industrial relations system. I really see this as something that individuals and employers will work through, unlikely to become a big source of industrial disputation.
What about productivity? Is it necessarily the case that we're more productive at home, or are more people slacking off when they're out of sight?
Well, some people are more productive working from home, some people are less productive working from home. But I think the main thing is that at an economy-wide level, I think there are good grounds for optimism that productivity is unlikely to fall overall, and it could even rise. Because if it's unlikely that most of the people who are now working from home are those who do it poorly. It's more likely that they're going to be the sorts of people who do it pretty well.
Have you been working from home?
I have. I'm working from home now.
As chair of the Productivity Commission, are you more productive and happier at home?
Look, I think I do some things well at home, but I certainly think there's a role for the sort of interaction that you get in the office. And we, like many, are thinking about hybrid models to try and get the best of both worlds.
That's Productivity Commission Chair Michael Brennan speaking with the ABC's Peter Ryan. Well, imagine completing 14 days of home isolation for COVID, only to be told if you step outside your door, you could face a $5,000 fine. That's the fit situation facing some residents of Western Sydney who've been stuck in their home for weeks, waiting for clearance from New South Wales Health. Earlier this week, you heard from a whistleblower in one of the public health call centres describing the delays and distress as the system is overloaded. We've had a big response to that story, and today you're going to hear from some of those who have been stranded at home.
My mum's in ICU with COVID.
It's the text message that no one wants to receive. Tash Moon's partner got a positive COVID result on the 29th of August.
Well, when we got that, you know, that text message, you know, that he was positive, like I remember that vividly. And even now as I go to describe it, like I'm shaking, like, you know, I had a cry. I felt like the blood had rushed out of my body. I started shaking, you know, like all we're thinking is, you know, we've got to act fast. What do we do? What do we do?
But when the Sydney woman and her family started contacting New South Wales Health for information, the confusion started. They were initially told they would need to isolate for 14 days. But then they found out they would first need to be cleared by health officials or face a $5,000 fine for leaving home without permission. Her husband was cleared after 19 days, but Tash Moon wasn't sure of her own status.
Who can afford $5,000 right now? I just want clear instructions. I just want answers.
17-year-old Jodie Willard tested positive on August 31st as part of surveillance screening for her job as a traffic controller. She received one call from New South Wales Health after the result, but that was it. She's been trying to get through to public health call centres to find out when she can leave home and go back to work.
And they're like, don't worry, someone's going to call you closer to your clearance date and they're going to provide you all the information of what you have to do, but I never got a call.
Western Sydney mother Sarah is also stuck in isolation. Her young son tested positive on August 26th. It was scary news. Sarah phoned number after number trying to get information. Initially, the family of five was told they would need to isolate for 14 days until their son was cleared on the 8th of September. But then the information changed. The rest of the family was told they would have to isolate for an extra 14 days. Exactly why is unclear. Sarah says it's been extremely frustrating.
All the text messages say 14 days. I spoke to someone this week and they told me, oh, you should be out, when I've got an email from someone else telling me that it should be up until the 23rd that we get out. So it doesn't seem like there's a consistent story across the same departments.
Sarah and her family, who are renovating their home, are now stuck in isolation in a serviced apartment for 28 days. While her son tested positive, the other members of the family have tested negative five times.
It's just making it very difficult for us as a family, but I'm sure that some of the staff are getting quite distressing phone calls from people in our situation.
It's been a confusing situation too for Western Sydney mother-to-be Kate. She's 3 months pregnant and tested positive to COVID on the 24th of August, a day after her partner.
I just broke down crying because my first thought was of our baby, because I woke up that morning with a really bad headache. So I just sort of knew at that time that that meant I was sick too.
The couple completed their 14 days of self-isolation, but couldn't get through to New South Wales Health to get clearance to leave home. Kate's partner works in the construction industry. He'd already missed weeks of work due to COVID restrictions. And after 3.5 weeks in self-isolation, he's now finally allowed to go out.
He got his clearance this morning after lots of phone calls made. And yeah, he finally got the email today.
It took Kate 19 days to get her own clearance from New South Wales Health. She ended up contacting her local Member of Parliament to have her case prioritised.
I'm feeling relieved. The baby is very healthy and doing well, is right where it needs to be. It's a pandemic baby. Not only did it go through a pandemic, but mum and dad survived having COVID as well.
That's Western Sydney mother-to-be Kate. And New South Wales Health responded to our questions earlier this week about delays to the public health COVID response. You can see it on our website. That's all from the World Today team for this Thursday. Tune in to the PM team this evening. Thanks for your company. We'll be back again at the same time tomorrow. I'm Sally Sara. Take care.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.